Looking at the devil, grinning at his gun. Fingers start shaking, I begin to run. Bullets start chasing, I begin to stop. We begin to wrestle, I was on the top. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Thank you for letting me be myself again. Stiff ball in the collar, fluffy in the face. Chit chat chatter trying, stuffy in the place. Thank you for the party, I could never stay. Many things is on my mind, words in the way. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Thank you for letting me be myself again. Dance to the music all night long. Every day people sing a simple song. Mama's so happy, Mama start to cry. Papa's still singing, you can make it if you try. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Thank you for letting me be myself again. Flaming eyes of people fear burning into you. Many men are missing much, hating what they do. Youth and truth are making love, digging for a start. Dying young's hard to take, selling out is harder. Thank you for letting me be myself again. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Thank you for letting me be myself again. Thank you for letting me be myself again. Hello, the world. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live from Revolution Radio. You can listen at revolution.radio or at freedomslips.com every Thursday from 8 to 10 Eastern Time on Studio A, and you'll hear our show. It's listener-supported radio, and they deserve your support. So head on over to revolution.radio and show them some love. Now, you can also listen live or to our archive shows at newdream.us, and you can learn about our guests there, too. I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests, Anthony Rayson, Larry Pinkney, M.K. Davis, Frank Cordero, and Phil Ferruggio. So this Thursday evening, we're gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, in Benton, Mississippi, in Des Moines, Iowa, in Port Orange, Florida, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in Chicago, Illinois, and wherever you are. In 2008, when we started the New American Dream website, and in 2011, the radio show, the premise has always been that there are no wrong questions. And what that meant was nobody is talking about things that are important. Nobody asking any questions. Please question this bullshit. And we should not feel we are doing anything wrong by asking questions. Those should be allowed, even encouraged. And if we are allowed to ask all the questions we have, and if there were someone willing to listen and provide answers, there would be no need for despair or dysfunction. We have the proof. Of course, Sandy Hook, Boston, Oklahoma City, JFK, RFK, King, Las Vegas were operations set up by the U.S. government and others. And by inference, every single one of the others, San Bernardino, LAX, Charlottesville, Orlando, the Wellstone murder, and at least a dozen others. Have you read your William Bloom and John Perkins and Douglas Ballantyne regarding the incredible dirty trick psyops the CIA and FBI have done over decades around the world to undermine any leader who tries to work for his or her people? Of course they would do the same thing here. Especially here, you old son of a bubba. You are the most important piece of the universe dominant scheme puzzle there has ever been in the history of history. Many of the things we accept as real are fake, and the things we think are ridiculous myths are real. Of course, Bigfoot is real. UFOs, of course, are real, and aliens, and we are conditioned to laugh at that, but there is no reason. While on the other hand, the fake events put on and acted out by the fakers are simply hilarious. Gene Rosen, H. Wayne Carver, Robbie Parker, the hole in Shanksville that is supposed to contain an airliner, the hole in the Pentagon that is supposed to contain an airliner, the footage showing an airliner melting into the World Trade Center exactly like Wile E. Coyote, the photos of the so-called victims of the Boston bombing sitting on the sidewalk waiting to begin to act in front of the cameras. We give mountains of money to the military to expand the empire and to kill and to gain even more wealth for the already filthy rich. If the soldiers really want to do something, they might go to Pennsylvania Avenue or the CIA building or the FBI building, where they can fight and die and actually do something about fighting for freedom and have their lives not be just a big joke wasted. We'll even tie yellow ribbons around the trees and the car antennas. Knock yourselves out. We don't even know we are living as part of an empire, good Americans, good Romans, and we do all we can to scratch and survive and live our lives while meanwhile, maybe they do these things to condition us, maybe because they are magicians, highly skilled. Distraction. Look here at this bullshit fake shooting at this little crossroads church in Texas, while overseas we bomb to smithereens Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and do our chicanery all over everywhere. Ukraine, South America, Central America, Africa, everywhere. It's a big deal. It's the whole enchilada. It's your parents' lives, your children and grandchildren. Take a moment, sit by yourself on a park bench, maybe put classical music or the logical song on your headphones and tell yourself, because even you don't really believe it. You don't want to. Nobody died at Sandy Hook or Boston. The whole Las Vegas shooting was an act. And there are, of course, more performances scheduled. We must pay half of our tax dollars to the military while our bridges and roads collapse under our feet, while we worry and whisper, why can't we have health care? Well, or don't think about it. Get busy as usual with your day-to-day routine in a dozen routine ways and not think about what all this means. What is the true reality of your life, your world? I do that all the time, try to escape, but there's nowhere to go. I've looked. Oh, and by the way, we didn't go to the moon either. And yet we believe in football and we believe in the military. We will sit for hours and through hundreds of brain-nothing commercials. The new American dream, not of new homes and toasters, but of becoming the kind of people we always thought we were. This is what the world needs. That is what the world is demanding of us right here, right now. We are the ones. For further information, I recommend the Corbett Report, How to Engineer a Crisis. Also, jimfetcher.blogspot.com. Also, False Flag Weekly News. Also, Truth Stream Media. Also, the American Everyman, Scott Creighton, and the sane progressive Debbie Lusignan. And I would also like to add Ken O'Keefe to this group. You'll find his videos on YouTube. And you will find that he's often angry when he speaks his truth, but I think that's okay. And I will add that I'm often, most often, probably not angry enough. For example, when I go to the movie and see that members of the military get a discount, I want to ask, where is my discount? I went to prison to fight against killing, not nearly as much as others, but I did my part, did what I could do against war, and people like me get nothing but disrespect in this American society, while killers get $2 off and free popcorn. Where's my fucking milk duds, America? You have no idea what it takes to go against friends, family, church, job, against your own mountain of self-doubt and imperfections. It's almost impossible, but some manage to get the job done. When I was in high school, there was not one adult that I remember ever telling me that killing or dying in Vietnam would be a bad thing. Not one. There were later ones like Dan Berrigan who gave me an alternate way of looking at America, and for that I'm very lucky. Most don't get that. We who go to prison to fight for tax dollars going to those who need it for those we really need get nothing but disrespect. Rodney Dangerfield would understand. We try against all odds to fight American society and American culture and the American military to keep us from murdering millions around the world, to stop the lies, and it's a good try, it's a good fight, mostly quixotic. And it's needed and worth your life. We sense that we should just take it with humility, and that's fine. But sometimes it's okay. It's needed, I think, to get a little angry. So I say thank you to Sophie Scholl and the other members of the White Rose in Nazi Germany, and to Penn Jones, to Jim Fetzer, to James Tracy, Kevin Barrett, Scott Creighton, Debbie Lusignan, Frank Cordero, and all those who fight day by day against the United States military and deep state, so that the little light of truth remains lit for one more day.
And now we join in progress another episode of The Americans. Well, the nuts have really arrived in Pyeongchang, South Korea for the Winter Olympics. Well, yeah, probably, said President Cosmo Nut when Imelda Nut told him she thought they'd left someone. He had a plan. In their rooms, Rusty the Patsy, Muhammad Ali the terrorist, Jews the limo driver, Slappy the house alien, Mama Pajama Jemima the MKUltra trainer, Warren Beatty, the secretary of getting things right, and Morgan Freeman, secretary of the War of the Worlds. They're painting each other's butts with devils and sickles and hammers and Stalin and Lenin. And Randall from Stevens Point is already in Pyeongchang. He's sitting right in the middle of Pyeongchang Square on a bench, and nobody can see him because he's wearing his camo socks from Cabela's. He's being approached by two South Korean policemen in heavy winter hats and parkas and boots, walkie-talkies, batons. Randall sees them walking slowly right toward him, but he knows they cannot see him. He smells that they're chewing apple-flavored gum, and one has the green gum moving in and out of his mouth rapidly. Chomp, chomp, chomp. You. One of the policemen addresses Randall and points to his socks with his billy club. Randall thinks the policeman must be crazy because he knows he's invisible because of his camo socks from Cabela's. You, sir, we like your camel socks. Where did you get them? Cabela's? Camel socks? Randall looks down at his socks. His socks have many tiny camels all over them. He thought he told the salesman camo. Yes, says Randall reluctantly. Randall's sure, since he's been spotted, that he'll be taken away to a concentration camp and tortured for info. So he knows he'd better think of something pretty quick. So he gets up, he kicked old Green Teeth right in the knee, and he lets out a yell that'll curl your hair. But before he can move, Randall grabbed a chair, says, watch him, folks. He's a thoroughly dangerous man. You may not know it. This man's a spy. He's an undercover agent for the FBI. He's been sent down here to infiltrate the Taliban. He was still bent over, holding on to his knee joint, but everybody else was looking and listening to Randall from Stevens Point. And he laid it on thicker and heavier as he went. He said, would you believe this man has gone as far as tearing Sun Myung Moon stickers off the bumpers of cars, and he voted for Boom Vroom June for president? Well, he's a friend of them long-haired hippie-type pinko fags. I bet you he's even got a Mongolian flag tacked up on the wall inside of his garage. He's a snake in the grass. I'll tell you guys, he may look dumb, but that's just a disguise. He's a mastermind in the ways of espionage. They all started looking real suspicious at him. And he jumped up and down and said, now, just wait a minute, Kim. You know he's lying. I've been living here all my life. I'm a faithful follower of Brother Bing Bong Birch, and I belong to the Booga Ooga Booga Baptist Church. I ain't even got a garage. You can call home, ask my wife. By this time, Randall had slipped away, possibly to join the Bubbas, camped right there in Pyeongchang Square. The Bubbas, Edward Snowden and Colin Kaepernick, have also arrived in Pyeongchang Town Square. Two of the Bubba children are entered in the bobsleigh competition, and because Russia can't be in the Olympics this year, they're going to compete as honorary Ruskies. They're changing their names to Bubba Barbuski and Bubba Bobovich. Meanwhile, Bubba Bubba and Bubba Brad and Bubba Jennifer and Bubba Carl are planning to compete in the Olympic Quidditch competition. They're running all around Pyeongchang Square with brooms between their legs. They have the RV right in the middle with their George Foreman grill going and tetherball. And they're sunning on the roof of the RV and playing jarts. And Fred, from the basement office of keeping all what should be kept secret, still secret from Americans. And the child left behind. They're left back in the big White House in the basement maintenance of secrets office, looking at old boxes of secrets. Fred pushes two boxes toward her on the floor. One's marked Edward Snowden, one Julian Assange, and one's marked Colin Kaepernick. One was marked Captain Kangaroo. Can I look at these, she says, looking around them in the semi-dark. Yeah, sure, I don't know why. I'm just a fucking little kid, right, said Fred? Right, said the child left behind. Yep, that's all I am, really. And so he got up and brought back an armload of cardboard boxes and set them down on the dusty cement floor in front of her. She began going through them, and she said the names out loud, softly. Philip Marshall, Michael Hastings, Mary Pinchot Meyer, Jack Ruby, Michael Connell, Dorothy Kilgallen, Barry Jennings, William Melvin Hicks, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Hunter S. Thompson, Gary Webb, Paul Wellstone, Skippy, the construction worker and self-taught on YouTube demolition expert, has walked right into the perfect big American White House in the perfect neighborhood on the perfect street. With his ropes, night vision goggles, face paint, grappling hooks, flares, camo pants, and his work shirt from the Pizza Palace. With the name tag Samantha, he tossed a rope and grappling hook up the banister to the second floor, tugged it to see that it was tight. Then took the stairs. He was shining a flashlight around for a while, then got hungry, went to the kitchen, where he met the child left behind and Fred, the maintenance man of secrets. You gotta see something, said the child left behind to Skippy, whom she recognized as one of the construction crew that had been working on the wall around the White House all summer. To separate the White House, the Congress, the CIA, the FBI, and the Washington Press Corps from normal human beings. No, I'm good, said Skippy. As soon as I finish my yogurt, I'm going to head back on upstairs. No, really, it's important, she tugged on his arm. Yeah, well, okay, said Skippy.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, we stopped at World News Trust and Nation of Change and many other sites. Here's Phil Ferrugia with It's the Umpire, Stupid.
Okay, Working Stiffs, I want to tell you, working with Chuck Gregory is an honor, but he reminds me, when we're doing the taping, of Ed Norton when Ralph Crampton was making a record to send to his wife. And he goes, you're on the air. Anyway, it's all right, Ma. I'm only bleeding. Ah. Many thanks to Bob Dylan for the song of the same name. What really rankles me is how so many of my friends, neighbors, and acquaintances seem to accept how far down the rabbit hole our American society has fallen. We live under the broken umbrella of an empire that cares not to protect the overwhelming majority of us. We live under the auspices of a regime that spends half of our hard-earned tax dollars on phony wars, illegal foreign occupations, and excessive militarism at home. Yet most of the lemmings I cohabit with are only concerned about trite news on sexual scandals and other base events that have nothing to do with their health or financial well-being. For every person who can profit from this insane stock market run-up, there are 1,000 times more folks who are lucky to afford the bare necessities of life. Many of us, even we who earn more than the median income level, still walk around with missing teeth, knees, and necks in need of operative repair, and so on. We Americans have become like those serfs on the feudal manors, working hard and still bowing and scraping when the lord of the manor passes. Why should the boss worry in most of our businesses when but less than 10% of private sector workers are in a union? There are fewer and fewer protections for working stiffs in America, and the empire knows it. When we who know better shout as loud as we can that the fat cat CEOs earn upwards of 300 times that of their workers, some serfs actually answer us, well, they worked hard for their success. They deserve it. Really? Well, in 1960, the top federal tax rate was at 90%, and the fat cats still did very well. Of course, no one paid 90%. They had accountants and plenty of write-offs. In 1985, the top rate was 50%. Now it is less than 39% and sinking lower as I write. So do the math. A fat cat CEO earns 300 times of his or her worker is most likely keeping double or triple what his counterparts of 32 or 57 years ago kept. Where is the disgust for most of my fellow working stiffs? To keep one soldier in Afghanistan costs the same as hiring 25 new firemen, policemen, or school teachers, each at a $40,000 a year salary. Hellfire missiles, $70,000 each, shot from a Reaper drone, cost of $28 million, many times not only kill innocents via collateral damage, but the spending, that spending redirected can help keep our neighborhood libraries open longer and filled with tons of new books. The real crime is in the fact that our empire has no business being in those countries, period. Monday, January 15th, was Reverend King's birthday. And this coming April will be the 50th anniversary of his assassination, for that matter. A year before he was murdered, Reverend King gave one of the most memorable speeches at the Riverside Church in New York City. For the first time, he publicly denounced our empire's involvement in Indochina. Here's what he said. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. My friends, America is truly running out of Band-Aids. Thank you.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and Earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now we hear from Mark, the world's most dangerous blogger. His parents have sent him out of their basement to the town square in Pingpong, South Korea, so he can do his live remote blogging, podcasting, tweeting, Instagramming, and Facebooking from the Winter Olympics, and they can vacuum all the fucking Cheetos crumbs filling up their basement.
This is Mark, the world's most dangerous blogger, coming to you live from the town square in Pingpong, South Korea. And remember, they don't want you to know that Cheetos dust and moon dust are both orange. Think about it. Go to a park bench, listen to Supertramp, and just think about it for a while. Do it today. Modern propaganda techniques utilized by the corporate state to enforce anti-democratic and destructive policies routinely entail the manufacture and manipulation of news events to mold public opinion, and as Edward Bernays put it, engineer consent towards certain ends. The U.S. provocation of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the Tonkin Gulf incident are obvious examples of such manufactured events. Similar techniques are apparent in the major political assassinations of the 1960s, where to this day, the public is prompted to partake in the false reality that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole culprit in the murder of President John F. Kennedy, which is Sirhan Sirhan was responsible for the death of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. For 16 years, a new generation of Americans has been born into the 9/11 myth that has been used to create the American warfare police state. The corrupt Bush and Obama and now Trump regimes used 9/11 to kill, maim, dispossess, and displace millions of Muslims in seven countries, none of whom had anything whatsoever to do with 9/11. According to the official story, on September 11, 2001, the vaunted national security state of the world's only superpower was defeated by a few young Saudi Arabians armed only with box cutters. If such a thing had actually happened, there would have been demands from the White House, from Congress, from the media for an investigation. Officials would have been held accountable for their failures. Heads would have rolled. Instead, the White House resisted for 1 year the 9/11 family's demands for an investigation. For the next 10 years, Osama bin Laden was the bogeyman that provided the excuse for Washington to kill countless numbers of Muslims. Then, suddenly on May 2, 2011, Obama claimed that U.S. Navy SEALs had killed bin Laden in Pakistan. Eyewitnesses on the scene contradicted the White House story. The numerous obituaries of bin Laden's death in December 2001 went down the memory hole, and the SEAL team died a few weeks later in a mysterious helicopter crash in Afghanistan. The thousands of sailors on the aircraft carrier from which bin Laden was said to have been dumped into the Indian Ocean wrote home that no such burial took place. When it became clear that the White House had blocked an independent investigation of the only three steel skyscrapers in world history to collapse as a result of low-temperature office fires, it was apparent there was a cover-up. After 16 years, people at home and abroad find the government story even less believable. Millions of Muslims have paid for this lie with their lives, the destruction of their families, and with their dislocation. Most Americans remain comfortable with the fact that their government has destroyed in whole or part seven countries based on a lie that launched the drive for Washington's world empire.
Our next guest for the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker in Des Moines, Iowa. Chuck talked to Frank earlier, and now we're going to listen to the conversation between Chuck Gregory in Fort Lauderdale and Frank Cordero in Des Moines.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
How you doing there in Florida?
Oh, we're doing pretty well. We're
starting to thaw out here. So this is the first day it hasn't been below zero.
You're
going to die if you go outside for too long.
We're having a cold snap here. I think it's in the 40s or 50s.
Oh, you poor people. Well, I think we're going to have a few days reprieve. So that's a good thing.
That is.
And
good.
It's just another week here. I'm trying to think the continued news of absence of Jess and Ruby continues to have its own reverberations in our lives. Still no word. So that's difficult. Doesn't get any easier to live with it. You just mention it and then you engage with things that are important and things that you got to do. Right now we've got a guest coming in next week. Last minute thing. This guy's his name's David Bradbury. Interesting character. He's a filmmaker from Australia, and he's done a lot of documentaries about the U.S. and its empire. Some of them are called. Let me see. He's got Nicaragua, No Partisan, Chile, Haste, Conduno. Frontline, South of the Border, and Public Enemy Number One.
Huh.
These are some things that he's done. And his most recent documentary is called America and Me. And he basically shot it during the inaugural of Trump last year on all the protests that were going on in Washington, D.C., and he spent time out in South Dakota with the Standing Rock folks. I'm bringing this up because he's stopping in Des Moines. He's doing these premiere showings of his documentary on the East Coast, New York and Washington. He's doing some stuff in Chicago, and he's going on to California. He's stopping in Des Moines primarily because of the witness that Jess and Ruby did. And show his America and Me documentary next Wednesday here at the Catholic Worker, and he wants to see activists and people involved in social justice. So I'm looking forward to meeting him. He's also wants to talk in depth about what Jess and Ruby are all about. I'll do the best I can. The other thing that's going on is that there was a article in the New York Catholic Worker paper by Tom Cornell, wonderful guy in his 80s, all about property damage in plowshares and the Catholic Worker movement. And Tom's of the opinion that the destruction of property is problematic, and made an assertion that Dorothy Day was not favorable to this. Of course, this ignited a lot of discussion. And I have this, as you know, I have this National Catholic Worker listserv on Google. And we've had these, I printed his article, got a response from Kieran O'Reilly. Kieran O'Reilly, one of the most famous Catholic Worker International. Kieran's the only guy who's done three plowshares actions on three different continents.
Quite
a guy. He was here in the 90s, and he joined an effort on a B-52 bomber on a runway about to go fight at the first Gulf War, 91. He was arrested with some other fellow Catholic workers, spent 23 months locked up, and then they deported him because he wasn't a U.S. citizen. He was from Australia. Went to Australia, helped out with Catholic workers there, and did a plowshares in Australia. And then he moved to London and Ireland, and he did a plowshares action during the 2003 war at the airport in Ireland, where American troops were coming through, stopping over, and then flying on to the Middle East. So just a remarkable character. But he started this discussion, it's been very good. I believe it's a lot of people are kind of owie about the issue. We came on really strong with the folks in New York because they're kind of they've taken a positional position about the plowshares actions and not being too keen on them. When in all reality, in the 80s and 90s, when these things were happening, that at least 40-50% of all participants in plowshares actions, in which I was part of, we're all from Catholic workers. So there's some very good, and the catalyst for this discussion, not only was Tom's article, but behind that was Jess and Ruby's action. And it's really got a lot of people talking. I just think that's great. And it's challenging. I'm going to continue to sing their praises and advocate for them. My position is that Jess and I are partners. We've been partners for 6 years. I have my gifts. She has hers. She can't stand mine. I love hers. I'm vocal. I'm public. I'll get in front of a camera. I'll say things. She just soon run away from all that stuff. She's an introvert and wants to just act up. She's been tolerant of me. And even though she's not here to defend herself, I'm going to defend her as best I can. And until she tells me to do otherwise, I'm going to keep doing it. I say that with pain in my heart because I miss her. I say that also seriously because, you know, I really don't know. I wish I could talk to her about it, but I can't. If I'm making a mistake, the only mistake I'm making is I'm making it for love, and I believe I'm doing the best I can by her. So you're still talking to a crazy, insane, in love guy who misses a girlfriend that walked out on him for who knows what reasons. in her wake, she and Ruby have left a lot of people scratching their heads saying, what was that? Who are those people? And let's talk about what they are all about. And that's kind of what I've
sure
been
got
doing.
People talking, didn't they?
It sure did. So,
Frank, I'm going to have to cut it short, but thank you so much. And, you know, your love for Jess, you know, resounds, it echoes. And
thank you.
I bet she even feels it. You know, from even though she may not hear this, I bet she feels it through the ether or whatever, you know, through a connection to God. I don't know. Anyway,
it's the spirits. It's the hawks. It's the animals. It's the birds.
Yes.
It's the clouds. The woman reads them all. So I hope I'm speaking to her through it, everything.
Okay.
I want to. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks again, Frank.
Thanks a lot.
Talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now,
Let's Try Democracy, a quiz to see if your school taught you state propaganda or what.
What percentage of foreign military troops stationed in nations around the world are U.S. troops?
Almost all of them. The United States has troops at its own bases and at bases identified as belonging to the host country all over the globe. Several hundred to over 1,000 bases, depending on how you count them. The rest of the world's 30 bases don't compare.
Let's Try Democracy, a quiz to see if your school taught you state propaganda or what. That's all, folks. That's the news. And we're out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Step up to the plate. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, bring something to the table. Have a good day. It is what it is. It's time to wake up. Your toast is ready. The bus is here. The world is on fire.
Our next guest of the show is Anthony Rayson. Anthony Rayson joins us each month from Chicago. Anthony is a former toll booth operator on the Chicago freeways. He's retired from that, but he is a publisher of zines. And he writes to prisoners, and prisoners write back, and he publishes it. And we're lucky to be able to talk to Anthony each month and get updated on how that's going. So we're going to listen to or trying to contact Anthony Rayson in Chicago right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Anthony. It's Chuck and Mike, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Okay, very good. Tonight I want to get back, talk about Vietnam. I don't think people realize how horrible this government has been and is, and this is a really good way to explain it. I wrote a piece in 92 entitled, The U.S. Bombs Away, Then Slinks Out of Vietnam. Basically a book reported by a book by Arnold Isaacs, which was Without Honor, Defeat in Vietnam and Cambodia. Isaacs' story begins in 72. After years of bloody fighting, secret negotiations are going on between Henry Kissinger and the North Vietnamese chief negotiator, Lê Duc Tho. Quang Tri City has been pulverized into rubble and the North's offensive has been blunted. The North Vietnamese break the negotiating impasse by removing their demand that the Thieu regime must go. All American objectives are agreed to. By 1972, the specific concrete demands of the United States has been reduced to exactly one. American prisoners must be returned. Beyond that, for American purposes, the U.S. asked Hanoi only for a restraint, that is, that it not take advantage of American disengagement to humiliate the U.S. Such were the goals of U.S. involvement. 2 million dead, a subcontinent destroyed for not a noble purpose, or even an evil one, anti-communism, but for no purpose whatsoever. It boiled down to a chimerical stab at retaining credibility. Kissinger arrives in Saigon 2 days before he is to finalize the agreement in Hanoi. For the South Vietnamese, an English-only contract copy is offered for their perusal and implied quick consent. In contrast, the communists were distributing and explaining it even to their low-level cadres in the field, while the Americans refused the same confidence to the president of the Allied country whose survival was at issue. South Vietnamese officials reacted to Kissinger's agreement anti-Semitically, saying he had no interest in Vietnam and wanted more American aid sent to Israel and that he only cared about the Nobel Peace Prize. Both of these opinions were not without factual merit. The U.S. so dominated every facet of South Vietnamese policies and military strategy that the Thieu regime had no plan for their country, so dependent had they become. The U.S. reneged on the ceasefire date because of Thieu's intransigence and promptly blame the impasse on the North. Kissinger still emerged from the crisis in pretty good shape for a man who had just deceived both his enemy and his ally and had led the United States into an act of bad faith that can have few parallels in its diplomatic history. Shortly after the supposed agreement, a massive American airlift began pouring new weaponry and equipment into South Vietnam. A U.S. general said of the shipment, if we had been given this aid to the North Vietnamese, they could have fought us for the rest of the century. Trying to wrest more concessions from the North to appease Thieu, the U.S. decided on a murderous bombing campaign by B-52s called Linebacker II, known to the rest of the world as the Christmas bombing. War by Tantrum, a columnist called it, a hellish finale to the one U.S. involvement and an evil presage of how the U.S. military would conduct future operations, i.e. Panama and Iraq. This concentration of bombing the enemy's civilians to expedite negotiations was cruelly copied by Israel as they pulverized Beirut in 1982. Schools, pagodas, markets, shops, and homes were all targets of the barbarous and criminal bombing Hanoi charged. Americans comparing those losses with the much higher ones of Dresden, Tokyo, replied if they had been trying to terrorize civilians, the casualties would have been much higher. Olaf Palm compared it to Nazi atrocities. Lamont likened it to Guernica. The London Daily Mirror said the bombing made the world recoil in revulsion. Die Zeit editorialized, even allies must call this a crime against humanity. The Christmas bombing was perceived by the U.S. as a sort of parting gift of destruction for Thu. A new ceasefire date was established for January 28, 1973. The agreement called for the Americans to contribute to the post-war reconstruction of North Vietnam without any political conditions. It also called for a withdrawal of North Vietnamese troops from Cambodia and an end to U.S. bombing. The ceasefire was ignored by both sides. Very few articles of the treaty were carried out, save for the return of U.S. prisoners and U.S. disengagement. Laos was bombed until the minute of the ceasefire, and Cambodia was massively bombed until Congress prohibited it in August of 73. Kissinger advocated resuming the bombing of North Vietnam after the peace accords to persuade them to cooperate in Laos and Cambodia, but he was a lone voice in the growing atmosphere of Watergate. In Laos, 2,992,000 tons of bombs were dropped from American planes, equal to all the tonnage dropped by the U.S. in the European and Pacific theaters in World War II. The planes came like birds, and the bombs fell like rain. To Washington, this was armed reconnaissance. The electronic war, costing $2 billion, saw the United States drop thousands of sensors to detect troops, movements, truck movement, a false alarm became a non-targetable activation. Laos offered American military planners a chance to test out their latest gadgetry. Mio Tribesman's Choice was supplying teenage boys to CIA-running guerrilla camps or be regarded as path that Lao and bomb mercilessly. The American CIA advisors flew out of the hills every night to the safety of Viet Tien. To replace the Hmong Mio tribesmen who had been decimated, Thai volunteers from the Thai army had been sheep-dipped with Lao identity cards and hustled to the deadly plain of Jars. The U.S. left lush Laos hideously cratered. The path that Lao attained much greater power in Laos than they had aspired to before the unprecedented bombing frenzy. The Control Office for South Vietnam, COSVN, was the holy grail sought by U.S. strategic planners and was used to justify wider, more intense, illegal, even by U.S. standards, bombing campaigns in Vietnam and Cambodia. The Khmer Rouge were almost non-existent until Sihanouk began attacking North Vietnamese and Viet Cong positions in Cambodia, combined with secret B-52 bombings. Hilltrops revolting against forced labor began to be supported by Viet forces. The act of deceit that began the American war in Cambodia, the secret B-52 bombing, set the pattern for everything that would follow. As in Laos, U.S. involvement in Cambodia focused on tactical opportunities and never on the possible consequences for those who lived there. Lon Nol's coup and subsequent unleashing of anti-Vietnamese passions had the consequence of dragging Cambodia into the U.S.-Vietnamese conflict. The murder of tens of thousands of unarmed Vietnamese civilians living inside Cambodia was a pre-Bosnian form of ethnic cleansing. Lon Nol was deluded into thinking he had full U.S. support. For domestic political reasons, Nixon could not commit the U.S. to his defense. The result of the war for Cambodia was a countryside controlled by North Vietnamese spawned communists and isolation for Phnom Penh. Lon Nol's troops were like lambs to the slaughter whenever engaged. Its tactics usually consisted of lining soldiers and vehicles up along a road as if on parade and ordering them to advance without flank security and without the slightest of an idea of where the enemy was. There was no supply system, so soldiers' families tagged along to keep the soldiers from starving. They slowed the troops to a crawl and added themselves to the casualty lists. American actions from 1969 on helped turn Cambodia into a slaughterhouse in which teenage peasant boys on both sides now murdered each other remindlessly and died in the mud almost without memory of why they fought. The land lay slathered in blood, but neither in early 1973 or later did the United States offer any plan or policy that promised anything but more fear, pain, and butchery. After the Paris Agreement, there were virtually no cooperation between North Vietnam and Khmer Rouge forces. From February 1973, for 6 months, bombing in Cambodia peaked and hit populous areas, particularly its heartland west of the Mekong River. That from above was epidemic. Casualties were anonymous yet enormous. It was if the bombers had sought to destroy the earth itself. This bombing had no tangible effect on communist gains, even though by the time of their entrance into Phnom Penh, the Khmer Rouge had suffered an astronomical casualty rate of 95%. Lon Nol held to the pipe dream that American B-52s are killing 1,000 enemy every day and the war will soon be over. The U.S. refused to acknowledge the enormous civilian suffering. Instead of sending food and medicines, they bombed the enemy and issued statements claiming the victims were adequately cared for. The explanations for this neglect are particularly galling. Pharmaceutical supplies were disallowed for fear of having these fall into communist hands or because misuse of the by the needy could cause a serious medical problem. They finally offered a few thousand Chox vitamins. The miserly relief effort coincided with the utter destruction of Cambodia's economy. As the infrastructure lay ruined, hyperinflation reigned. The fury of the bombing and its aimlessness made the European community feel that the U.S. had gone crazy. More and more, the bombing seemed to take on a quality of rage, as if pure violence could succeed in achieving American goals when nothing else could. At the height of the climactic siege in Phnom Penh, for the privileged elite, there were tennis matches, nightclubs, expensive French meals, and opulent brandy-drenched dinner parties. Phnom Penh was at the height of desperation when the Khmer Rouge entered. A truly massive relief effort would be needed to prevent mass starvation and disease. Mogadishu? This would not be forthcoming. The Khmer Rouge were spawned and nurtured in the crucible of hell. When they brought their antithesis of light to the Cambodian people, it had a logical dialectic of unleashed evil. Rwanda comes to mind. The lasting image of Cambodia is shelves upon shelves of human skulls. When Congress finally cut off aid early in 1975, it hit the Third Reich like a gigantic concussion bomb. In March and April of 75, during the collapse of the government, higher-ranking officers were the first to run away. As usual, the original masterminds have access to an escape route. Some were captured and done justice to, and some received refuge in America, Canada, and France, where they're ill-gotten well.
We're going to have to cut you off at this point.
Okay. Maybe I'll finish next time.
To the station break. But thank you very much.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. Thanks, if you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Anti-aircraft guns pointed to action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning.
We are far stronger than we were 10 weeks ago.
All general quarters, all hands at your battle stations.
If you're nervous, count your toes. I'll do the mastermind around here.
You have not seen it, do not know what hell looks like from the top.
Check it out every Tuesday and Saturday on Revolution Radio. It's a double dose of the internationally recognized renegade military historian, Douglas Dietrich.
You'll stay right where you are till I tell you to move out.
Yeah, that's right. Tuesdays from 10 to midnight Eastern Time. Join Douglas Dietrich as he exposes the truth in hidden history on his show Critical Omissions. And then our human weapon of mass destruction is back once again to take your calls on Saturday night firing lines. Both from 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Larry Pinkney. Larry Pinkney joins us each month from Minneapolis. Larry is a member of the Black Panther Party in the 60s and 70s. He's a radio show host and author and activist. And we're going to attempt to contact Larry Pinkney in Minneapolis right about now.
Good evening. Larry Pinkney speaking.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck and Mike and the new American Dream Radio Show. And you're on the air.
Well, thank you so much, Brothers Chuck and Brother Mike. Appreciate it. Today is, Thursday, the 18th of January, 2018. I would like briefly to discuss something that I think more of us should pay attention to, and that's called principles. Principles. Do we have principles? I sometimes wonder how many of those that we think we agree with actually have principles. Without principles, there can be no genuine struggle. No genuine struggle. You know, I had the opportunity a day or two ago to speak with dear sister Cindy Sheehan. And for those who may not know, Cindy's book, her latest book, she's written a number of books, but her latest book, which is titled The Obama Files, Chronicles of an Award-Winning War Criminal. The Obama Files, Chronicles of an Award-Winning War Criminal by Cindy Sheehan. If you don't have it, please go online and get it. In any event, Cindy and I were talking about a number of things, but primarily principles. you know, I remember very, very well, and perhaps many of you do as well, when Cindy's son died, I believe it was in Afghanistan, and this really, really shook her up for many reasons, not just losing a loved one, but the fact that she began to really, really deeply explore. And she'd been doing that prior, but she really began to deeply explore what the heck is going on here. Why are citizens of this country abroad dying, being killed for rights that we cannot even exercise in this country? I reminded Cindy as I was talking to her a couple of days ago, I reminded her that when she was out and she was literally going up against the G.W. Bush administration, why the Democratic Party or the Democrats, so-called Democrats, I call them the demonic Democrats, they loved it. They loved it. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Goldfarb mother, yes, yes. But as soon as the war criminal, drone man, Barack Obama came in, and by the way, when Obama came in, there were approximately four major wars that the three or four major wars that the U.S. was engaged in. When he left office, there were seven major wars that the U.S. was engaged in. Thank you, Mr. Drone Man Obama. Where are the principles? What happened? When Obama became president, Cindy was out there saying, you know, this is wrong. You must not do this. Why do you have a, quote, kill list? And the Democrats were overwhelmingly silent. What happened to the anti-war, pro-peace movement? What happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. They told Cindy Sheehan to go home and shut up. They told Cindy Sheehan, don't talk about 9/11. Don't talk about Mr. Obama, drone man's murders, his kill list. Don't talk about these things. Why? Because we have a so-called black president, a Democrat in. I ask the question, what happened to principles? Where are our principles? What happened? I think we need to be honest with ourselves. Now that Donald J. Trump is president of the United States, why, there seems to be this amazing awakening. It doesn't matter that President Trump took us out of the TPP, something that Hillary would never have done. The TPP, so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. It doesn't matter. All we can concentrate on is what? Well, the way he drinks his coffee, the way he holds his cup, but this, I mean, you know, this is hypocrisy. We need to stop being hypocritical. We need to start being honest. Now it appears that the demonic Democrats, in heavy quotation marks, Democrats, have now become the allies of the so-called deep state, i.e. the FBI, the CIA, the NSA. All the same leadership of those organizations that brought about serious persecution of political activists in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even the 90s. But somehow, it's okay. Somehow, they have apparently chosen to side with the deep state, which, by the way, people denied existed. But now, it's clear that there is a deep state. And we who have been engaged in struggle for the past 40, 50, or 60 years know that. So I want to go back to this thing of principle. Do we have principles or do we not? Are we on this plantation or that plantation? We should not be on any plantation. We should be honest, critical thinkers. We should call it as it really is. You've got absolute lunatics out there. And it saddens me to say this. So-called Democrats, people like Pelosi, like John Lewis, like Maxine Waters, lunatics. It's as if they want war. They want war. They want war with the formidable nuclear power of the Russian Federation. And that wouldn't be war, my brothers and sisters. It would be annihilation for all of us, both them and us. What happened to principles? This is something that we need to be honest with ourselves about. So I get very passionate about this because the more I watch this insanity, the more aggrieved I become, the more incensed I become at the hypocrisy of the so-called left, the so-called Democrats, the so-called liberals. Where is their genuine integrity? I would submit to you that most of them have none. It is time for us to be critical thinkers. I have often said that on this program, and I say it once again. It is not about left or right. It is not about left or right. We're not birds. We don't have wings. It is about honesty. It is about critical thinking. And I just have to say that I hope that more and more, an increasing amount of people are waking up to this hypocrisy. I don't care what their so-called ideology, what I often call idiotology. I don't care what they think their ideology is. Wake up to the reality. Get off of the plantation. Get off of it. Suddenly, now the Democrats are talking about what? Racism. Racism? Indeed. Let's think about racism, and let's think about that in the vein, if you will, of former U.S. Senator Robert Byrd, former Ku Klux Klan leader and recruiter, close friend and ally of Hillary Clinton. Oh, yeah, the one who called black folks super predators, the one who called anybody who didn't support her deplorable. Yes. It's time for us to be honest. Racism, of course, is real, but it is not limited to one side or the other. I'm asking you, brothers and sisters out there in the new American dream world, to think about this, to be honest. It is time for us to find a new way, a different way, an honest way, a critically thinking way. So I must apologize for this tirade, quote unquote, or this harangue. But the more I pay attention to this, and I was just thinking about the conversation between myself and the sister Cindy Sheehan, the more I said, you know what, I have to address this. I have to address this. And Cindy did a great job herself of addressing it. Once I get the interview from a couple of days ago, I'll send it to you, Chuck and Mike, and if you want to use it, please feel free to do so. At any rate, please let us stick to principles. First of all, let's get some principles and let's stick to them. Let's be honest. So as we said originally back in the day, all power to the people. That means exactly what it says. Black, white, brown, red, and yellow. All power to the people. Stop being sucked in into this plantation or that plantation. Get off the plantation. Get off of it totally and completely. Let us once again be free, or at least die in the effort. And we won't die in the effort, because freedom is never free. Freedom is an ongoing struggle. It is a constant struggle. But it takes principles and it takes honesty. So I'm probably going over my time. I apologize for that. But I just really, really wanted to make that point about principles very, very clear. We don't support the rhino Republicans or the demonic Democrats. All power to the people. Thank you so much. Love you, brothers and sisters. Love you all.
Thank you, Larry. Talk to you next time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now, Milk Duds Last Forever, a review of the new Hollywood blockbuster, The Post, from New American Dream movie critic Sancho Panza. As Robert Crowley, CIA agent, says, I can guarantee that the press will either keep very, very quiet about you or will make a fool out of you. We still do control the press, and if we say to trash an enemy, they will do it. We control most of the major publishers, or if we don't, they would never dare to put out anything that would get us upset. Hell, we have our man right there in the New York Times, and they jump through the hoops. Believe me, the Times is in our pocket, absolutely. One thing the CIA's Frank Wisner did was to build up a very cooperative media, and that includes book publishers. Even if some big publishing house printed a sensitive book, it would never see the light of day. Why? Because our people would block it. It's that simple. They would ruin you as they have ruined many other authors who have gone before you for daring to speak ill of them. Can you imagine the New York Times reviewing it? I think not. I think not ever. One phone call from us and into the wastebasket with any kind of commentary, good or bad, the blanket of silence would descend upon you, believe me. Silly idealists somehow believe we have a free press here, but it is as tightly controlled as it was in Russia or was in Hitler's Germany. A review of the new blockbuster movie, The Post, by New American Dream movie critic Sancho Panza. Our next guest of the show is M.K. Davis. M.K. Davis joins us each month from Benton, Mississippi. Sometimes M.K. chooses to talk about Bigfoot, sometimes about other things. And we're going to find out what M.K. wants to talk about tonight. So Chuck will try to contact M.K. Davis right now in Benton, Mississippi.
Hello.
Well, hello, M.K. It's Chuck and Mike, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Hello. Tonight I'm going to discuss something a little bit different. It's sort of Bigfoot-like. About maybe, it's been a few months ago, I went out to see an Indian mount. It was near the town of Inverness, and actually it's a little closer to the town of Isola, Mississippi. And you have to go way out, maybe a mile and a half across a field to get to the mound, and I wanted to do drone footage of the mound. So I packed my drone and walked that distance, and it was kind of muddy, and eventually made my way around the end of the field toward a lake. And when I got to the lake, something hollered at me or screamed at me, and I saw an animal go down the embankment, and I saw it go up the side of a tree or just lean against the side of a tree. And so I just kind of hollered out back at it, to make sure that there was no, encounter with something that could hurt you. There was not a surprise encounter, he would know I was here, but, nothing in response. So I went on and got my footage. And when I was coming back, I got to that spot. There was a great big polecat laying there, one of the biggest I've ever seen, and its guts were hanging out, and it had been dispatched in such a manner that it never sprayed. There was no odor to it. I was in a hurry, so I made my way on out of there, and so just before this last bout of cold, there was I actually went to see a ball game at my son's house in Indianola. And when I got there, they said, well, you should have been here a few minutes earlier. There was a newscast that had a man who had been, his animals had been attacked by what he called a chupacabra. And, he had killed eight of his goats. And anyway, I missed that, but I did call the TV station and I asked them to, if they could put me, you know, me and him together so I could talk to the man. And they did that. It took several days, but the man called me and I went and did an interview with him. And he described his goats as being beheaded, and then their guts gone and there was no blood, which does sound a lot like what they say, you know, chupacabras do. And he evidently had gotten on the net and he had decided that's what must have happened, you know, killed his goats. But he said this wasn't the only time. Exactly 1 year prior, he had a lot of hawks killed in the same manner in that same pen. So this was his second attack. And he had a neighbor that actually got a visual on it. And I went and spoke with him. And the neighbor said that he it was like nothing he had ever seen before. He saw it out his window in his back of his house, looking out across toward a bayou. And there was two of them that came out into his backyard, and his wife saw them first, and she hollered at him to come. And he said that they had a back that was like a rainbow. And I asked him, "You meant colors?" He said, no. And it was steeply arched, and the head was really low. He didn't see a tail. The head was like near the ground. And he estimated it was about 5 feet long and about up to his waist, and he was 6 feet high. So he estimated the weight maybe a couple of hundred pounds at least, you know. So it appears that, you know, with corroboration from a neighbor that maybe, you know, there was something, some kind of cryptid there. Well, I went and got on Google Earth and got a satellite image that was pretty recent, and I was looking down at it and I realized that it wasn't very far from where the screaming on the lake bank took place. As a matter of fact, there seemed to be a circle of activity that you could draw a line from there back to the chupacabra attack or whatever it was, and then around to an area called Sky Lake that there's been a lot of activity in. There's been a stick formations or a stick pile, some kind of shelter, bent over trees. That some of that's classic Bigfoot type stuff. But it all seemed to be an area of mystery, and it involved these old Oxbow lakes and these forests that are prehistoric. They're old forests that have trees in them that are run 1500 years old and better, and had not been disturbed. And, you know, since those days, it's uncut. So it kind of caught my attention. As a matter of fact, I plan to make another trip and do some riding at night on those roads along those bayous and do a little investigation of my own. Basically, just, you know, sometimes you try to put yourself in a position to get lucky, to see something. I'm not sure what that is, but it's capable of slaughtering animals. Large numbers of them in very short order. And whatever it is gifted with something, you know, the sharp teeth and the sharp claws, because it said it cut the heads off. It almost looked like they were cut with a knife. The guts are kind of like, that's what made me think Bigfoot, because Bigfoot are known to take the insides, to prefer the insides, because they're easy to get to. There's no bones. You don't have to tear or break a tooth or anything like that. It's just soft, full of nutrition, your liver, your heart, kidneys, and even the eyes in some cases. You know, the eyes are, have a lot of nutrition in them. So when he said that, that they got in the guts and left the meat, my mind kind of went toward Bigfoot, but they were, the guy that actually saw them said, no, 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 they weren't Bigfoot. They were some kind of a creature, you know, that like he'd never seen. And his wife saw him first and she was afraid. And he said he watched him for 30 minutes. He was so caught up in it that he didn't realize that there was his gun right by the door. So when he finally did realize it, he got his gun and went out back and they were gone. I guess they heard him coming or whatever. So you know, it's a eyewitness testimony along with dead animals. So something killed them. What would a chupacabra be doing, you know, out there in the Delta of, in Mississippi where there's so much agriculture? The particular area where it's in, where this took place, it was a lot of agriculture, sure enough, but it was a lot of those big oxbow lakes that were left over from the days of the dinosaurs. I mean, they were that old. And they, and if something wanted some relic or something unusual, it would be a good hiding place. And I kind of get the impression that whatever it was, whatever it is, makes its way around a circuit of these lakes and these areas of woodlands around them that people don't go into much. And
okay, thank you. We're going to have to cut this short, but thank you so much. That was really fascinating. We look forward to talking to you again. Come on.
I'll report on what I find the next time I go around.
Excellent. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Bitcoin, Litecoin, Mycoin, Yourcoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now a blast from the past that turns out to be not that long ago. A New American Dream radio show news note regarding the NBC internal investigation of Brian Williams. As you recall, NBC News President Deborah Turnus announced the internal investigation in a memo to staff. As you would expect, we have a team dedicated to gathering the facts to help us make sense of all that has transpired, Turnus wrote. We're working on what the best next steps are. And when we have something to communicate, we will, of course, share it with you. And that is so cool. Deborah Turnus, the president of NBC, that is way up there, pretty high in American society, and she is going to investigate that one of her star reporters lied to the American people. That is so awesome. We are pretty sure by the time she is done, she will tell us why NBC colluded with the CIA and the Israeli Mossad to produce the 9/11 hoax and production, the fake Boston bombing, and Sandy Hook. This is so cool. We can't wait because it's so cool. Because NBC is investigating itself and they are going to tell us the truth. Nice. This is what makes this country so cool. And now a word from New American Dream bowling writer Jeffrey Lebowski.
Brian Williams' greatest lie. No controversy ensued when Williams and NBC colleague Tom Brokaw repeatedly upheld the Warren Commission's lone assassin conspiracy theory on November 22, 2013. NBC suspended Brian Williams for 6 months on February 10, 2015. The fashionable anchor admitted to lying about being involved in a life-threatening combat situation while reporting in Iraq over a decade ago. Yet a survey of Williams' career indicates this isn't the first time he's been dishonest with the American people. In one important instance, while broadcasting from Dallas, Texas on November 22, 2013, Williams began the NBC Nightly News by remarking, "We're in Dealey Plaza, just across from the sixth-floor window in the Texas School Book Depository Building, where three shots were fired 50 years ago today that changed the course of American history." The statement flies in the face of honest reportage by upholding the powerful myth devised by the Warren Commission that former U.S. Marine and intelligence operative Lee Harvey Oswald was the principal assassin in President Kennedy's murder. The American public can now point to overwhelming evidence presented by attorney Mark Lane, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, the U.S. Congress, and a host of other researchers indicating that the three shots fired from the Texas School Book Depository was a CIA-contrived conspiracy theory. In fact, at least three sharpshooter teams killed Kennedy and wounded Texas Governor John Connally in Dealey Plaza in a triangulated crossfire. Williams, from November 22, 1963, just over 6 hours after the shots were fired from the building here behind us, meaning this place and this city would never be the same. It's not only Williams perpetuating the lie, one might safely conclude he's also a conspiracy theorist, and he's among the world's most famous journalists working at a major U.S. broadcast network that intends to bring him back after a six-month hiatus for a second chance. Later in this November 22, 2013 broadcast, Williams introduced fellow NBC anchor Tom Brokaw. On November 22nd in 1963, Williams begins, Tom Brokaw was a young reporter in Omaha. He read the news of the assassination on the air, in fact. Amazingly, after 50 years, Brokaw had yet to exercise journalistic due diligence by publicly questioning the implausible government cover story suggesting that Oswald killed Kennedy. Nor does Brokaw take the opportunity to do so during this broadcast, thus perpetuating one of the U.S. government's greatest lies. Thus, two of America's most prominent journalists flagrantly misled the American public on this notable 2013 broadcast. Yet no controversy surrounds their truly astounding assertions. Perhaps we need to ask, how differently would Williams or Brokaw behave as official press agents for the U.S. government? Brian Williams' deception points to a larger truth. A major career journalist's incorrect or embellished personal recollections are the stuff of controversy, while in contrast, when it comes to the country's most momentous events, from the JFK assassination to 9/11, the war on terror, weapons of mass destruction, star journalists are compelled to spread and perpetuate massive lies. So long as those falsehoods are sanctioned and promoted by America's national security state, these celebs are allowed to proceed without question. Indeed, such figures are lauded for their journalistic service. The public be damned. Well, it's been another long week in Moonrock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. It was, for me, the world of Dick and Jane, the world that every child should inhabit, a world with yellow brick roads, the security of parental love, full stomachs, overflowing hearts filled with warm feelings. Bob Keesham, Captain Kangaroo, forward to the world of Dick and Jane. The American dream has dangled before our eyes for over 200 years. The American dream is the goal that we Americans hold on to when everything else is gone. The American dream is our ideal. Too bad. It's just a dream. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns, while the world wails, fists clenched, eyes blazing, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia, while they sleep on through the alarm, the house of fire. We pick up our story after Michael M., staff member at Sun God Group Home, has sped off on his moped to tell the people at the workshop that there's a sit-down strike taking place in the Sun God driveway, and they will be a little late. On his way, he swerved to miss a little girl, jumped the curb, and rammed his blue flake helmet into a war memorial for World War II at the city park, breaking the war memorial. And now, the National Guard and police have stormed the park and taken Michael M. away in a National Guard helicopter. Where did they take him? Well, let's take a look, shall we? Michael M. is in prison for having rammed World War II with a blue flake helmet. But he loves Homeland, and all he really wants to do is get free so he can get registered for the Home Helper Show drawing and make his wife proud and his children happy. M. knelt in his run. Otherfield asked him if he still needed to get registered. Yeah. A new poll would be great, said Otherfield. I know. Why don't you go? Go? Get registered. Get registered? Like how? Ask the guards. Ask them what? If you can go. Tell them you need to get registered for a new pool and to be on television. F you. F me? No, really. Yeah, right. Otherfield shuffled over on his knees. Offer them something. They're not unreasonable. The cries of someone in another kennel caused M to go rigid involuntarily. offer. They like candy, said other people. Baubles, trinkets. Trinkets, baubles, M thought. He put his chin to his chest to look down his hood at his putty white doughy stomach and his rose panties and scabbed knees. They like gold, said Otherfield. Gold teeth, gold fillings. I didn't need to hear that, said M. At 4:30, a guard brought two pans into M's run and placed them on the cement. One was filled to the brim with warm water. The other had a mush, not unlike soggy dog food. The guard pulled M's hood up so that he could lean over to eat, careful as always not to fall in face first. When M had finished his dinner, the guard took him under the arm to pull him to his feet and walk him to his cage. When the guard let him in, M crawled to his bed, the box being too short to allow him to stand. M now slept on a wire mattress without handcuffs or hood. There was a 5-gallon bucket for his restroom, a wash rag that was dipped into cold water once in a while, then set back in the cage so he could freshen up. As M lay on his back in the darkness of his wooden box, its crisscross pattern formed in his back and arms and legs. Outside, he could hear the speakers repeating the sound of an AM radio dial being continually changed. He heard shouting, as he did every night, plus screams, cries, groans, and barking. M thought of his children. The way the 4-year-old giggled when you pushed him on the swing, and how the 2-year-old walked into the kitchen in the morning with her footy pajamas clutching her baby doll. He tried to remember his wife's face, but got only her hair, her body, and her hands, the way she liked to keep her fingernails long and different colors. He lay there, maybe he fell asleep, and he heard a dog bark and an owl hoot in response. M heard bootstraps on cement and keys. The door opened outward, tossing the light from the tower onto the box floor. A guard threw down a pile of clothes. Go ahead. M crawled up slowly, tentatively put on his t-shirt, socks, tennis shoes, and jeans with small tears and bloodstains from the crash into the war memorial. What is happening? M asked. The guard shined a flashlight into his own hand and showed 2 gold teeth, an open pack of juicy fruit gum, and 3 buttons, one red, one green, one silver. You're free to go, said another guard outside the door. M let one guard escort him out of the unit. He heard dogs barking and whining and realized what Otherfield had done. The full moon showed the guard towers, razor wire, box latrines, in an elegant light. The guard, rifle slung over his shoulder, walked with M along the long dirt lane to the mailbox in the shape of a tractor. He nodded down the road and turned to walk slowly back, kicking up dirt with a purpose on each left foot stride. M gazed back at the prison camp, at the light still on in the warden's living room, at how the smoke from the guard quarters rose straight up and the big flag at the checkpoint hung limp. No wind. Beside, turned toward the road, began walking, scuffling, kicking at rocks and rifts. He began to hum, then sing. And I'll gladly stand right next to you and defend her. M kept one walking down the side of the graveled country road. He wondered how far he was from homeland or anywhere. He recalled all the towns and fields and the smells of pigs and cows they'd flown over to get here. He wondered if he could walk that far back. M stopped and turned in a circle, looked up, dropped his mouth open to look at all the stars. He stared at the moon, thought he saw the American flag. He kept gazing, catching himself from falling backward. He turned his head slightly and tried looking at the moon at an angle with peripheral vision. He tried holding one hand over one eye, then the other eye, then resumed walking, and past shadows of cows. A deer stopped in front of him, turned, then flagged its tail to bound into the ditch and over the fence. M began to see better. He stopped at the mouth of a short farm lane and looked inside the house. He could see the stocking feet of a man with the footrest of his recliner up. In his hand was the clicker pointed at the TV, and on the screen was the Home Helper show. M looked up and down the road, hustled over to a wide tree to peek around. On the television, he saw the handsome young construction crew leaning on shovels, taking a break from the digging of a swimming pool in some lucky family's backyard. They gathered together for a sideways group hug, waving to the camera. M sighed a big sigh. He began to hum, and then he puffed up his chest. He began to sing, "I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free." He stumbled through the coarse grass and weeds to sit against a thick, rough tree. He set his head against the bark and let his arms drop to his sides at the same time that he stretched his legs out as far as they would reach. "I see the USA in a Chevrolet." M closed his eyes for a moment, let out a long sigh, then opened them and enjoyed the full moon and the stars. "Can't forget the men who died," he sang in a low tone to himself, "and gave this life to me." M looked for the sky god flag on the moon, and there it was again, just where his father told him it was, above the corner of the mouth on the right side, like a beauty mark. M wondered if the man on the moon was gay, but agreed with himself it couldn't be true. "It's more like a mole," he said out loud. The stars blinked like they did on the opening promo for Bewitched. "Flintstones, meet the Flintstones," M sang. "In the town of Bedrock, it's a place right out of history. Have a yabba dabba do time. Old time." M let his eyes close. He opened them. The land was lit. The sun was not in sight. M looked for the guards, listened for the breakfast pans, heard a dog bark, went rigid. He winced and turned his head away from the sound. His hands became fists. His toes curled, his butt muscles balled, his neck muscles constricted, his jaw clenched. He groaned and moved his legs, brought his knees to his chest, wrapped his arms around them. He sucked in a deep breath, smiled, and sang to himself softly, "Best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup." A rooster crowed from an invisible perch. A car rumble rolled down the gravel road, not unlike the roar of a fighter jet just before you see it. M did not know whether to wave for help or hide. Car and its smoke drew closer. M scooched around to the far side of the tree as it passed. He put his flat hands on his knees and watched the sunrise. He heard pheasants cackle, mourning doves cuckoo. M thought about the group home, realized he probably didn't have a job, remembered washing dishes after supper with the clients, radio tuned to oldies. He'd be dancing in the kitchen, eating the leftovers off the plates, having water fights with the spray hose. He remembered sitting outside on summer nights, talking to Rosie about politics and the twins and the best flavors of juice boxes and cigarettes. They dream of what it would be like to be tall or to drive forever on one tank of gas. He liked working there, he guessed. I do okay. I'm no hero, he said out loud. He wondered if he liked being there because those folks were also outcasts. M became hungry, stood up by climbing the tree, walked off through the grass and the poop and the weeds and the Canadian thistle. He used a corner post to get over the fence, then jogged down the ditch and out again. He went on along the side of the road, his head down, kicking at rocks and sticks. M rounded a long curve in the road where it bent back and headed into a long straightaway in a valley filled with trees and bees and corn and birds. He stopped at a private drive with a mailbox in the shape of a grain elevator. The lane was sprinkled with wood chips. His stomach rumbled out loud and he dreamed of a stream of cold water pouring from a hose. M headed down the long drive, swiping at the chip soccer style, saying, "It's good," raising his hands. The lane curved around a pond and ran between two rows of aspen trees. A driveway led to a basketball hoop attached to a one-story gray brick home. M put his palms on the hedge, looked into the window and saw Walker, Texas Ranger on the TV screen. "May I help you?" A melodramatic bull in the pasture to M's left caused him to leave his feet and jump backwards. Tried to smile, not succeeding. "Walker," he said, pointing at the window. "Yes," said the man. "Wouldn't miss it in this house. Who might you be, sir?" The man looked familiar. A new pitch black BJ was parked in the drive. I escaped from the prison farm. M pointed across the fields. I think they call me the big evil one. I'm M. The man grabbed his red suspenders and leaned back to roar, "Ha! You are the big evil one, asshole crap turd. You are M. I did not mean to insult you, but I'm afraid not." "Not," said M to himself. "Now, who are you? What are you doing in my head at 7 in the a.m.? "Well, I told you." Okay. "You be M." Man came closer, put his arm around M. "I'll be Matt Dillon, but tomorrow I get to be M. Offer you some breakfast, coffee, or do you not need food?" "I do," said Al, letting the man herd him inside. They walked into the kitchen, sat at the circular counter in the middle of the red and white elegant 1950s Ma and Pa farm-style kitchen. A wave of laughter pealed from the other room. The man went to check. He returned to the kitchen. Some guy super glued his posterior to the toilet seat. Had it on the news. Man ran a hand back through his stylishly greased red hair. He had very white skin, freckles on his face, arms and hands. Sat a cup of coffee in front of him, some cereal boxes, bowl, spoon, plastic jug of milk with a blue cap. In waltzed a little girl in a pretty white dress with white bows in her red hair. She sat up on the counter next to M as if he were a member of the family. "Aren't you going to say grace?" she asked M as she began digging in. M stopped his spoon, held it still in his bowl, bowed his head. The girl parked her elbows on the table and pressed her hands flat together and leaned her forehead against them. She closed her eyes. "Oh, God," she began in a voice that made Em smile. "Thank you for the rain and the corn and the farmers and also for the moisture. Oh, Jesus, for the farmers. Oh, God, and also for the corn and the rain. For this we pray, oh God, thank you for this day and for the farmers. Amen, O God. M. Renewed working his cereal scooping drag line. You're Mr. M. Yep. Daddy, here's M, she sang, running into the living room as M slurped. They walked back into the kitchen holding hands. Glory seems to believe you're the man who tried to run her over. M chewed and looked at him, and the little girl. He recalled the girl in the crosswalk, the black SUV, the crash into the war memorial. He stopped chewing. He swallowed. I didn't try to. I tried not to. The throttle sticks. We'd like to thank you for joining us on the New American Dream Radio Show. We hope you'll be back next week and every week. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Thank you, Chuck, for all you do, the interviews, the technical work, the website, the archives, your singing and all, and thanks to our guests, Larry Pinkney, Anthony Racing, M.K. Davis, Phil Ferruccio, and
being foreclosed, people working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country was founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to the banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means. This is our bank. This is our war.
Hello.
And this is our plan of attack.
Hello, hello.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy.
Are you there?
So consider this justice.
Yes, Mike.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution. Radio! Safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents. Imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank, or all the banks for that matter. Are your banking records safe in your hands? So when they get things fixed and repaired, you can say,